From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Obama administration lashes out at the newly reelected Israeli leader.
He walked back from commitments that Israel had previously made to a two-state solution.
As negotiations continue, President Obama delivers a message to the people of Iran, and the U.S. First Lady heads to Cambodia. That's all ahead. I'm Ira Melman. President Barack Obama has told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu he will reassess aspects of the U.S.-Israeli relationship after the Israeli leader's comments rejecting a two-state solution. Mr. Obama delivered the message Thursday during a telephone call to congratulate Mr. Netanyahu on his election victory this week. That, according to a White House official speaking on condition of anonymity. Said the official, the president told the prime minister that we will need to reassess our options following the prime minister's new positions and comments regarding the two-state solution. In the lead-up to the Tuesday election, Prime Minister Netanyahu told Israeli media that he would never support the creation of a Palestinian state as a way to resolve the long-standing Israel-Palestinian crisis. Thursday, he appeared to step away from those statements, telling several U.S. media outlets that he does not object to a demilitarized Palestinian state, but adding that is not achievable at the current time. The White House released a statement saying that during their phone call, Mr. Obama stressed to Mr. Netanyahu the importance of the United States, the United States places on the close military, intelligence, and security cooperation with Israel. However, Obama administration officials also signaled Thursday they do not accept the prime minister's clarifications in regard to the two-state solution, Washington's preferred way to resolve the Middle East conflict. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said it's pretty clear that Israel is no longer committed to a two-state solution and warned of consequences for actions that we take at the United Nations and other places. Here's an excerpt from Mr. Earnest's White House news briefing.
What is apparent is that in the context of the campaign and while he was the sitting prime minister of Israel, he walked back from commitments that Israel had previously made to a two-state solution. Now, to be clear, the United States, for more than a decade, under both Democratic and Republican presidents, has strongly supported this approach to trying to address the conflict between the Palestinian people and our allies in Israel. And it's worth pointing out that this is a policy that was supported and in place under both Democratic and Republican presidents. It is also a policy that was and has, on more than one occasion, been unanimously supported by Democrats and Republicans in Congress. As recently as December of last year, the United States House of Representatives, on a voice vote, so essentially without objection, passed the U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Act, in which the pursuit of a two-state solution was identified as our goal to resolve this conflict. So, it is, as we mentioned yesterday, cause for the United States to evaluate what our path is forward given the Prime Minister's comments. And so we'll have to sort of see what sort of policy and priorities the Prime Minister chooses. But we certainly are in a position to evaluate our approach to these issues given that the Prime Minister essentially backed away from commitments that Israel had previously made to this effort.
And you stand by that the need to reevaluate, to look at your options, despite what he said today. You don't think that now, based on his flip back, that what he said previously was a campaign promise to get votes? Yeah.
Well, the motivation of the Prime Minister and the comments that he made, I think it was even just earlier this week, is something that you'll have to take up with him. What is clear is the United States has been clear about our policy for some time. And it also merits pointing out that we pursue this policy not just because it's convenient. In fact, it's not convenient. It's rather difficult, as has been well chronicled by all of you in this room. But we have been in pursuit of this goal because we believe that it is clearly in the best interests of our closest ally in the region. We believe that it is in the clear interest of Israel to establish a Jewish and democratic state of Israel living side by side in peace and security with a sovereign Palestinian state. That is a way for us to diffuse tensions in the region. It's not going to diffuse all of them, but it certainly would substantially reduce tensions in the region. And it would, of course, serve the national security interests of the United States, but it's the best way for us to provide and protect the Israeli people. Again, it doesn't remove all threats, but it certainly is the way for us to resolve what is a prominent point of contention in this region of the world. And the comments from Prime Minister Netanyahu to walk away from that commitment just this week has prompted the United States to evaluate our position on these matters going forward.
Where forward is remains to be seen. Washington, a permanent member of the UN Security Council, has long used its veto-wielding power to shield Israel from resolutions that are critical of its actions toward the Palestinians. Well, U.S. officials this week suggested the White House is reconsidering that diplomatic shield. Israel's continued settlement activity in the Palestinian territories and Mr. Netanyahu's outspoken opposition to nuclear talks with Iran have soured Israel's traditionally close ties with the United States. Word now that Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, John Boehner, is expected to visit Israel in about a week. Boehner, a member of the Republican Party, is the man who invited Prime Minister Netanyahu to make his controversial speech in Congress. Senior Israeli officials who asked to remain anonymous told Israel's Haaretz newspaper that Boehner will begin his visit, which has not yet been announced publicly, on March 31st, heading a delegation of Republican Congress members. An American organization critical of Mr. Netanyahu's Americas for Peace Now says it worries that a new Netanyahu administration will undermine international efforts to create a two-state solution. Ori Neer is the group's spokesman. Senior Middle East reporter for VOA, Mohammed El-Shenawi, asked Neer whether Mr. Netanyahu's election victory indicates that most Israelis oppose a peace agreement with the Palestinians.
No, it does not. And polls have been showing over and over again that Israelis, by a very large margin, support a two-state solution with the Palestinians. The problem is that they can't see it happening in the immediate future, and that they have been impacted by scare tactics by their leaders, particularly by Prime Minister Netanyahu, who has said that a two-state solution, a Palestinian state in the West Bank, is a big threat that could bring about a scenario that is similar to what happened in Gaza. We've been talking about the Islamic State coming to the West Bank if Israel leaves the West Bank and hands it over to the Palestinians and things of that sort. And those kinds of scare tactics worked, I think, in swaying Israelis from their pragmatic views that support the two-state solution to ones that are more influenced by fear.
David Axelrod, President Obama's former senior advisor, said that Mr. Netanyahu's last-minute stand against a Palestinian state might have helped ensure him another victory. How would you expect the U.S. reaction to shutting down the two-state solution approach?
I think that the U.S. Reaction would be pretty harsh. I think that the U.S. will not allow an Israeli prime minister, particularly an Israeli prime minister who in the past has endorsed, with some qualification, but has endorsed the two-state solution, to walk back on it. I think that this is a major foundation of American policy in the Middle East, and they will not allow an Israeli prime minister to walk back on it. They will demand that he recommit to it, and if he doesn't, I think that it may have some price tag. Perhaps the first time, at least in the history of the Obama administration, some kind of a price tag. And for example, I think that it is quite likely that the United States will not give Israel the kind of diplomatic safety net, particularly in international organizations like the UN, as it has done in the past. So I definitely think that there's going to be major, major pressure coming from the administration on Prime Minister Netanyahu personally, and maybe to a lesser extent on his cabinet, but particularly on Prime Minister Netanyahu, to recommit to the two-state solution.
That was Ori Neer of Americans for Peace Now speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. President Obama delivering a New Year's message to Iranians, telling them this year represents the best opportunity in decades to pursue a different relationship between their two countries. The president's comments to Iranians as they celebrate Nowruz come as a March 31st deadline approaches for reaching a framework agreement to limit Iran's nuclear program in exchange for lifting international sanctions against Tehran.
This year, we have the best opportunity in decades to pursue a different future between our countries. My message to you, the people of Iran, is that together we have to speak up for the future we seek. As I've said many times before, I believe that our countries should be able to resolve this issue peacefully with diplomacy. This is what's at stake today, and this moment may not come again soon. I believe that our nations have a historic opportunity to resolve this issue peacefully, an opportunity we should not miss.
In the video remarks, Mr. Obama said Iran's leaders should choose between what he called a reasonable nuclear deal, which he said would end Iran's international isolation and provide greater opportunities for the Iranian people. If a deal isn't reached, the president said Iran will continue on the path it's on today, a path that has isolated Iran and the Iranian people from so much of the world, caused so much hardship for Iranian families, and deprived so many young Iranians of the jobs and opportunities they deserve. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said Friday via Twitter that Iranians have already made their choice and gained with dignity. He said it's high time for the U.S. and its allies to choose pressure or agreement. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with Zarif for what is supposed to be the final day of the current round of talks held in Lausanne, Switzerland. American and European officials have said a breakthrough is not likely, adding the talks may be extended. Indonesia says it will sign a defense agreement with Japan, a move certain to raise concerns in China, with which Jakarta already has a military pact. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Indonesia on Friday announced that a non-binding defense agreement will be signed with Japan next week when President Joko Widodo visits Tokyo for talks with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Indonesian officials say the agreement will increase cooperation in military technology, training, and peacekeeping operations, a significant boost above their current defense relationship, which is essentially limited to the exchange of military students. The new pact might also include exchanging intelligence information. Indonesia has enjoyed a more formal military relationship with China, with which it has a binding agreement and has purchased Chinese missiles and other equipment. President Widodo is also to visit China immediately after Japan. Foreign Ministry spokesman Armanata Nasir says the president will raise the contentious South China Sea territorial dispute in both Tokyo and Beijing.
Of course, the issue of regional peace and stability will be discussed both in Japan and China, because the importance of ensuring that the region continues to benefit from stability and peace, because this is a major factor in the contribution for the region's economic development.
Japan does not have claims in the South China Sea, but it and China do dispute the sovereignty of uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, which are controlled by Japan. Indonesia, the largest country in Southeast Asia in terms of size and population, has taken a neutral stance on territorial disputes, as Nasir points out, offering itself as a broker to its neighbors in China.
We are a non-claiming country, but we are committed to helping ensure that there can be trust within countries, claiming countries on this issue. We have pushed for the negotiation through ASEAN in particular, and I think there are certain progress there where China and the other claimants, ASEAN members, have been discussing this issue.
Under Prime Minister Abe, Japan has bolstered its security policy, increasing ties with the Philippines and Vietnam, which also have territorial disputes with China. Closer military ties with Jakarta would make the Japanese defense industry more competitive with South Korean manufacturers of military equipment. At home, Mr. Abe has sought to loosen restrictions contained in Japan's pacifist constitution, imposed on it by the United States after the Japanese defeat in the Second World War. But that has caused considerable anxiety in China and on the Korean Peninsula, which suffered at the hands of Japan's colonialism in the first half of the 20th century. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama is scheduled to arrive in Cambodia Friday as part of her two-nation Asian trip to promote education for girls. Her first stop was Japan, a partner in the new Let Girls Learn initiative. Robert Carmichael has more for VOA from Phnom Penh.
Michelle Obama's visit to Cambodia marks the first time that the wife of a sitting U.S. president has visited the small Southeast Asian nation. She will be welcomed by Bun Rani, the wife of Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen. The First Lady's visit is targeted at advancing the cause of education for girls, part of the U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative. Cambodia is one of 11 countries where Let Girls Learn is being implemented. During her two-day stay in the northwestern city of Siem Reap, Michelle Obama is scheduled to meet high school students to hear how U.S.-funded programs have helped them. She will also address U.S. Peace Corps volunteers working in Cambodia. Kim Darrah heads the Cambodia Office of World Education, a non-profit that works with the Ministry of Education to improve access to schooling. Darrah explains that girls in Cambodia face specific challenges. While most villages have primary schools close by, for example, secondary schools are often farther away. That can make travel to and from school dangerous for girls. Another important issue is the lack of latrines and washing facilities in many rural schools.
They need to go to the toilet. They have to go home and then they don't come back to school again. If this happens often, then this can be the way that makes them don't feel comfortable at school, and as a result, they drop out. And so the project helped the school to identify the problems.
Cambodia has 2.9 million children in school. Just under half are girls. The Let Girls Learn program, which the U.S. government recently launched, aims not only to break down the barriers that prevent 62 million girls worldwide from attending school, but also, by working at the community level, to keep millions more from dropping out. Adolescent girls are particularly badly affected, and the cost of girls losing access to education is immense. Studies show a direct link between more education for girls and a healthier and wealthier population. Kim Darrah says providing scholarships for girls is one way to improve the chance that they will study further. Financial pressures on impoverished rural families, he says, cause many girls to quit school early.
In Cambodia, the culture, they like to keep girls, especially to stay at home to take care of their younger siblings rather than their boys.
While the Cambodian government has welcomed Mrs. Obama's input on education, it is likely to be less enthusiastic about reports that she will speak about politics and human rights. That she plans to raise those issues was made clear in a briefing given prior to her departure from the United States. Evan Medeiros, the senior director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council, told reporters that the First Lady would meet with members of Cambodian civil society, quote, to reinforce our view of the importance of having an open and inclusive political system to allow civil society to have a role in good governance, end quote. Medeiros said Michelle Obama would also speak publicly about areas of importance to the U.S., including equal access to economic opportunity. That, in one of the world's most corrupt nations, might well annoy Phnom Penh, although a Cambodian government spokesman told VOA Friday that the First Lady would be welcome to raise any topic she liked. Mrs. Obama's main message, though, will be about improving learning for girls. Kim Darrah believes that will prove valuable.
Our visit to Cambodia will be a message to Cambodian people, especially encouraging girls to go to school and to show them that they have opportunity, the same as the opportunity for the boys. So I have a strong belief that this will be a positive result.
Michelle Obama is scheduled to leave Cambodia on Sunday. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
More than 500 students in an impoverished Indian state have been caught and expelled for cheating on the ongoing state school leaving examinations. Photographs and video of men climbing the outside wall of an exam center in Bihar State to give the test takers answer sheets have emerged in the media. Reuters reported some sheets were folded into paper airplanes and launched into the test rooms. Bihar's education minister blames the students' parents. Prashant Kumar Sahi said, you tell us what the government can do to stop cheating if parents and relatives aren't ready to cooperate. said more than 1 million students are taking the test this week. Some parents say the students are not prepared to take the test because the schools lack qualified teachers. Parents also blame authorities for failing to make adequate arrangements for taking the test. The exams are viewed by many as life-changing that could transform the lives of students who have grown up in poverty. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day. Visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 20th, 1815, Napoleon entered Paris with his army after escaping from exile, beginning his so-called Hundred Days Rule. 5 days later, some leading nations of Europe formed a coalition to remove Napoleon from power, thus setting off the Napoleonic Wars. On this day in 1852, American abolitionist and author Harriet Beecher Stowe published her classic book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. In 1854, the Republican Party of the United States was organized in Ripon, Wisconsin. In 1904, behavioral psychologist, author, and philosopher B.F. Skinner was born in Susquehanna, Pennsylvania. In 1942, U.S. General Douglas MacArthur, following a harrowing escape from approaching Japanese forces in the Philippines, vowed, "I will return." I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Years of political unrest have roiled Egypt's economy and caused instability that resulted in foreign investors pulling out, which worsened the problem, and over time, the situation snowballed. Today, in order to rise out of the morass, the country's economy needs an influx of some $200 to $300 billion in foreign investment. So, in an effort to make Egypt more attractive to investors, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi launched significant reforms to kickstart the economy and improve the business climate. These include cutting income tax rates, establishing new mechanisms to resolve commercial disputes, and passing a new law providing new incentives and legal protections for investment. All of these things are key to attracting new investment, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the Egypt Economic Development Conference, which took place in mid-March in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Everybody knows that money, capital, behaves in fairly predictable ways, and those who make decisions about investment look for certainty. They look for confidence. They look for the knowledge that, if they invest, what they're investing in will be a transparent and accountable transaction. The United States believes that as the region's most populous country, Egypt has a crucial impact on the entire region. So a stable, prosperous Egypt means a stable, prosperous region. That is why the U.S. invests in Egypt, about $2.2 billion worth, or 20% of all direct foreign investment. We are providing economic assistance in the hundreds of millions of dollars that will be directed to small business enterprises and to new startups because we want to see a sustainable economy grow in Egypt, said Secretary of State Kerry. It is strategically important to this region and to all of us who are looking for stability and for a better standard of living and greater inclusivity and participation by citizens. It is important to make certain that Egypt can move along the road to development and to the full achievement of its democratic aspirations. And that's something the United States will remain committed to.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.